microfinance is highly diverse and borrowers use credit for all sorts of different reasons. A one-size-fits-all model doesn't effectively serve all borrowers.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, the latest Vox Dev Lit, published today, 30th of January, is on the subject of microfinance, which is pervasive, popular, and it's often controversial as well. So what have we learned about what works, how it works, and who it helps, and what is there still left to understand? Simon Quinn of Imperial College, Mohamed Mekki of the University of Oxford, and Jin Kai of the University of Maryland are the authors. They all join me now. Simon, welcome.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
Mohamed.
Hi, Tim.
And Jin.
Hi, Dean.
First of all, Jin, what do we define as microfinance?
Microfinance refers to a range of financial services provided to individuals or small businesses who typically lack access to traditional banking and financial systems. It is designed to help low-income individuals and communities improve their economic conditions by offering small loans, saving accounts, insurance, and other financial products. So we can see that microfinance is a very broad concept. But in this review, we focus specifically on the microcredit component and living for like another day, the other various form of microfinance. Microfinance has several key features, including small amounts of loans, focusing on marginalized populations such as women, rural communities, and informal sector workers. It also usually requires no or minimal collaterals. And most importantly, it usually uses group lending models where individuals form groups themselves and those within a group are jointly responsible for repaying loans.
So give us some history on this, Jin. What was its origin and how common is it today?
Many people would think microfinance was originated in the 1970s by Mohamed Yunus, who's an economist from Bangladesh, where he initiated a small-scale program by lending like $27 to a group of 42 women in a rural village to help them purchase materials for their crops. So the success of this experiment led to the establishment of the Grameen Bank in 1983. But in fact, there's a much longer history of pre-modern microfinance. And specifically, the first documented joint liability lending was introduced in the early 17th century in Ireland by Jonathan Swift, who is an Irish writer and clergyman. So he created funds to provide small loans to poor borrowers who would collectively guarantee each other's repayment. Then in the late 1790s in the U.S., Benjamin Franklin set up funds in Philadelphia and Boston to support young tradespeople and enables them to buy tools and start businesses. And those were also joint liability loans kept with affordable interest rates and profits were reinvested further lending and community projects. So these pre-modern practices laid the groundwork for the principles of microfinance, particularly the importance of group lending and reinvestment into the community. So the challenges and innovations in addressing financial exclusion are not new, but actually is a part of a centuries-long evolution in economic systems. And now is actually obviously a global phenomenon and has been widely recognized as a tool for poverty alleviation and social economic development. It's not only common in developing regions, but also gained attention in developed countries to support marginalized entrepreneurs. So for example, there's major organizations like BRAC, Finca, and Kiva. They operate internationally and are providing microloans to millions of borrowers.
That was a much richer history than I was expecting to hear. For the purposes of your review, looking at the existing research on how microfinance works, credit isn't requested randomly, it isn't given randomly. So I would imagine that the research to measure its impact must have been really hard to do.
You're perfectly right. So it's challenging to identify the causal impact of microfinance because of different types of selection bias, right? And there's bias on both the supply and demand side. So for example, on the demand side, people who choose to borrow are likely to differ from non-borrowers, and usually we are unable to control all dimensions of difference in the analysis. And on the supply side, lenders might select certain regions or markets to enter and certain customers to approve. And those selection criteria are usually not very transparent to researchers. Mm-hmm. So this is why there's been a large number of randomized evaluations of microfinance programs in recent years. But actually, even among those randomized evaluations, there's still a lot of challenges. So for example, one key challenge of randomized evaluations of microfinance is that it's only feasible to randomize in places where microfinance is expanding to new markets or is expanding to new borrowers in the existing locations. Mm-hmm. So this is why those studies providing information on marginal or complier population of borrowers affected by the expansion and says nothing about the impact on inframarginal or always taker borrowers. But there's a recent progress on this, which was made by Abhijit Banerjee and co-authors, where they tried to estimate impact on experienced borrowers using an episode in India where a microfinance institution increased existing clients' fees in randomly selected villages, which reduced take-up substantially. And interestingly, they find that the impact of the microfinance are strikingly similar to the previous estimates for new clients. Another challenge is that the lack of statistical power, because the loan take-up rates are typically low. Some evaluations choose to restrict their sampling frames to individuals who are more likely to accept microcredit if treated. So given those challenges, I guess more work is needed to develop novel methodologies to more rigorously evaluate microfinance programs.
Yes, and it's these are good reasons why the Vox DevLit is so valuable to be able to spell all of this out. Now, I did mention that microfinance has its critics. We will probably touch on why that is later when we get into some of the detail. But is it still growing, the number of users, the number of providers?
Yes, actually, yes. So the number of users and providers in the microfinance sector is still growing globally, although at a slower rate than during its initial growth phase. So while traditional microfinance institutions have saturated in some regions, providers are expanding their services to include other things like saving, insurance, remittance solutions. So this broadens the utility of microfinance products. And in addition to that, there's various type of technologies like mobile platforms, blockchain, and AI-based tools for credit scoring. And those are further enhancing the efficiency and accessibility in the sector. And as a result, the microfinance market is projected to grow at an annual growth rate of approximately 14% in the next 10 years, and its total value is expected to reach about $450 billion by the year 2031. And this upward trend is also supported by increasing government initiatives, sustainable practices, and regulatory frameworks that promote consumer protection and trust within the industry.
Tell me about the original concept of microcredit. What was it designed to achieve and how would it achieve it?
Yeah, thanks very much for having us. It's a lot of fun to be able to sit and talk about this. Part of what I find fascinating about discussing microfinance is there really isn't a single original concept, but instead mm-hmm. we should think about a variety of different original concepts. And let me flag two in particular. The first is about accumulating what Stuart Rutherford and others have called a usefully large sum. So if my wife and I, for example, go down the street to a large store here in the UK and we buy a dishwasher, somebody is going to offer us credit, and they're going to offer us credit at probably very attractive terms, often 0% APR these days in the UK.
Yeah.
Similarly, in England, about 95% of first-time home buyers are buying on a mortgage. Mm-hmm. So if we think about, for example, finance in the UK, a lot of the purpose of finance is to accumulate large sums. And that has been one of the key original concepts of microfinance. So for example, Jing spoke about Benjamin Franklin and his early microfinance programs. A lot of that was really motivated by trying to think about young apprentices and helping them to buy tools, in other words, large lumpy purchases that they couldn't otherwise access. On the other hand, go back to Muhammad Yunus's 2006 Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. Part of the emphasis that he places on the value of microfinance is it avoids poor households needing to fall into the hands of people who are lending very high rates or lending on other unconscionable terms. Part of what's interesting about microfinance is that it is actually trying to do different things, and often trying to do different things for different borrower pools. In future, you might see microfinance products being more specifically adapted to the kinds of purposes that people need. So if it's about a large lump sum to purchase a fixed asset for a business, then maybe you want to look at asset-based microfinance. If it's about small consumer loans or trying to get to the end of the month, then you might think about consumer protection being built in more explicitly. So I think that's part of what makes it really an interesting field to study.
It was considered to be a way to be transformative, to lift people out of poverty. What's the evidence? And this is a big question. What's the evidence that it's achieved those transformative benefits?
It's a really good point. And I think a lot of people could have been forgiven, perhaps 20 years ago, for thinking that there was a narrative that the poor are all wonderful entrepreneurs. We just need to lend them money. And then, as you say, we'll see transformational benefits.
Right.
And unfortunately, 20 years of research have showed that that is not the case. In fact, it was 10 years ago this month that we saw a set of 7 very influential randomized controlled trials published in the American Economic Journal Applied Economics. And essentially what we find from the literature over the last 20 years is that I think we can say that the standard model of microcredit does not have transformational benefits on average. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, an important headline, which is probably quite sobering relative to some of the narratives we hear. But it's also a headline message that is worth unpacking. So take it one at a time. First, we don't see transformational benefits, but we do see a lot of advantages to microcredit. I dare say that nobody's going to accuse me of having transformational benefits from having an overdraft facility, for example, but a lot of us are very grateful for having an overdraft facility. So there's lots of ways in which having extra liquidity can be very beneficial to households, even though I agree it's certainly not transformational. Second, we don't see benefits on average, but there's often different subpopulations who will do very well. And there's one in particular that's attracted attention, and those are people who are effective entrepreneurs or established entrepreneurs, where the evidence seems to be that microfinance can help them, particularly if it's microfinance helping them to buy a large productive asset. And the third point I'll make briefly is that we talk about the standard model. Those initial randomized control trials had a heavy emphasis on testing, as I say, a standard model of microfinance, where, for example, we're often thinking about high interest rates could easily be 20% APR and above, and often needing to repay, make the first repayment very soon after the initial dispersal, which can be a real problem if you want to make a lumpy investment that helps you to innovate in some way. And I know Muhammad will want to talk later on about innovation, but in summary, it feels like no, it's not transformational, but yes, there's a lot of potential benefits and a lot of interesting space for innovating, which again, I think is why it's a really exciting area to have this discussion.
And one of those original projected benefits was the empowerment of women. Has it been successful in this?
Well, yes and no. And let me give a rather generalized answer here. As a general rule, in the same way that we shouldn't think that microfinance has been transformational in a financial sense, you wouldn't say that microfinance has been intrinsically sort of deeply empowering to women. Mm-hmm. However, let me add 2 important caveats. One is, if you can find a microfinance product that, for example, increases household income substantially, then there's every reason to think that some empowerment of women is going to come through that. So for example, in joint work in Pakistan with Faisal Bari and Kashif Malik, Muhammad and I ran a microfinance RCT, which increases, among other things, household spending on education, including particularly the education of girls. Mm-hmm. So while you wouldn't say increases women's empowerment across the board, you'll certainly find important instances of that. And second, there seems to be a growing body of evidence indicating that the way that finance can enter the household may matter. So for example, if you have a microfinance product that is particularly targeted to women or is generating income that will go first to the women's account, then I think you might anticipate benefits in terms of empowerment. But as a general rule, my view is that we think about empowerment of women through the same lens as we might think about improvements in overall household income and consumption, which is to say that we would expect it in some cases, but not necessarily across the board.
Have we been surprised by the ways in which the recipients of microfinance have chosen to use it?
Well, for me, I think the big surprise comes from the distinction that I discussed earlier.
Yeah.
That you might go into a particular setting thinking, I've got a budding set of entrepreneurs here and I'm going to see business growth. And actually what you find is that actually, no, it may be valuable, but it might be valuable for liquidity purposes. Or you might go to a pool of borrowers and think that this is going to be useful because it provides a bit of liquidity. And some borrowers, the term sometimes used, gung-ho entrepreneurs, might find a use for it, that there might be a productive investment that they were unable to take. So I think it's not necessarily that we've been shocked across the board, but that I think there will always be surprises about the different purposes to which financing can be put.
It's very obvious talking to you that there are many different interpretations of this model. Have we found that there is a large geographical variation in how it works and why it works?
So I might offend some listeners by saying this, but I'm going to say, to a first order, I think the answer is no. But let me be very careful. Of course, nobody ever wants to look at an economic policy and say it applies in the same way across the world. You're always going to have different local contexts and lenders will behave in different ways. My interpretation of the literature is that, to a first order, what we need to think about is who is borrowing and what are they borrowing for? And that where in the world they're borrowing is, of course, always relevant to any study, but it's going to be less important than those first two questions for some of the reasons we've discussed.
So, Mohammed, one of the most interesting features of the original model was that it featured group lending. Why did it do this? And what have we learned about group lending?
Group lending has really been a hallmark of early microfinance and one of the most distinctive features, and attracted a lot of attention initially from economists, especially from a theoretical perspective, because of its ability to address adverse selection and moral hazard. Adverse selection refers to the difficulty that a lender faces in distinguishing between a low risk and a high risk borrower. Mm-hmm. And moral hazard describes the risk that a borrower may take undue risks with the funds once they take them. So they may use them for a purpose which wasn't as stated or intended. And so by holding these small groups jointly liable for each other, this group lending model incentivizes peers to screen each other, to monitor the activities, and also possibly to enforce. And so it really reduces the risks for lenders. Those are some of the theorized benefits, but there are also potentially challenges. Free riding or excessive peer pressure. People may be too harsh on each other if somebody misses a payment. And so we describe in the lit some experimental evidence that builds on some of the theoretical motivations. Essentially, the evidence shows that removing the formal joint liability requirement does not necessarily negatively impact repayment rates. So we see that even when borrowers are transitioned from a joint liability to an individual liability contract, repayment rates often stay quite high. And that's likely because of informal mechanisms that remain even under individual liability contracts, such as social capital, public repayments, and community dynamics. And so this is consistent with a broader move from microfinance institutions towards individual liability and away from joint liability. Although, as mentioned, many of them have retained some group elements because, you know, trust, local conditions make such a lending model quite attractive.
One other mechanism to encourage borrowers to repay has been to say, well, you're not going to get any more credit if you default. Has this been effective?
Yes, exactly. So this has been another very distinctive aspect of microcredit. And so the effectiveness of denying future access to loans as a strategy to reduce default on the current loan has been a key feature of much research that we discuss in the lit. So we've referred to this as dynamic incentives, whereby a borrower's access to a future loan, often a larger future loan and potentially better terms, maybe a longer duration, lower interest rate, depends on their current repayment behavior. And so I referred to adverse selection and moral hazard previously, and these kinds of dynamic incentives are believed to also potentially mitigate both adverse selection by discouraging a riskier borrower from applying initially, and moral hazard by encouraging good behavior once one takes a loan. And so the empirical evidence supports this idea that dynamic incentives can indeed reduce default rates. For example, we have experiments that show that a lender's ability to enforce such incentives does lead to lower default rates and reduce adverse selection, as borrowers are more likely to self-select into appropriately sized loans, like they don't take a loan that's too big for them, and they're more likely to make better use of the funds. However, I just wanted to flag that dynamic incentives and the power of dynamic incentives can really be context dependent. And so in areas where there's high mobility of clients and lots of competition between microfinance institutions, intense competition, there may be less pressure that the borrower feels to maintain good repayment behavior with one particular institution, knowing that they can just go somewhere else and take another loan. The success really does depend on the broader lending environment and the specific mechanisms in place to enforce it.
Now, another big question, what do we know about the timing, either in the giving of the loans or repaying the loans? How often, when they're given, how much flexibility?
So I think the research has shown us that the timing and frequency of loan disbursement and repayment schedules can really be quite important for the effectiveness of microcredit. So the traditional model, as you suggested, emphasizes high frequency repayment schedules. I mean, people often have to pay 1 week after receiving the loan or 2 weeks after they're receiving the loan and continue to pay very high frequency every week or every 2 weeks. When you speak to some financial institutions, they tell you that this is required because it basically instills discipline in borrowers. They turn up, you see that they're there, provides an early signal of repayment difficulties, and also splits up the payments into smaller, more manageable amounts for the borrowers, which may be quite effective, for example, if they're facing savings constraints. However, flexibility in repayment schedule can also be quite important for some borrowers, especially if we're talking about businesses who have access to profitable investment opportunities, but which may take some time to bear fruit or may be quite risky. Timing of the loan dispersal is critical as well. So when the loan is received in a more agricultural setting, researchers show that if you disperse loans at harvest time, it can really help farmers avoid selling their crops when prices are low and everybody is selling. And so providing them an appropriately timed loan can help them make use of the fact that if they wait a little bit time, they can sell for a higher price. And so it addresses something that as economists, we sometimes call liquidity constraints, which can really be important in these kind of environments, especially seasonal industries, where this kind of one size fits all model and a misalignment between the repayment structure of a contract and the income cycle of the borrower can really exacerbate financial strain. It's something that can be fixed quite easily. Repayment flexibility once the loan has been disbursed, this has also been shown to be quite important, especially for small firms. For example, you can imagine an initial grace period where you have, say, 2 months before you have to make that first payment. It gives a borrower additional time to allocate the funds, especially for a small firm, towards a higher return, possibly riskier investment. And research has shown that this has led to sustained business growth and increased incomes. And other research has shown that it doesn't necessarily need to be just at the start of a loan. So deferrable payment vouchers, which allow borrowers to postpone payments in the future when they're maybe facing shock, have also been shown to be quite effective. Essentially, they're providing what we call implicit insurance against shocks and allowing borrowers to maintain stability during unforeseen challenges. Whereas if you remember the example that I just gave about the seasonality, that's a very much foreseen issue that we were discussing. Some of this work on repayment flexibility has actually demonstrated big intergenerational impacts. And so we're talking about helping out small firms face liquidity challenges, and this has led to actually really big improvements for the next generation. Although I've mentioned some of the benefits, repayment flexibility is not universally beneficial. So there are, for example, first-time borrowers who maybe do need that financial discipline that I mentioned initially. And so for some first-time borrowers, maybe some repayment rigidity can actually encourage better habits and reduce default risk and act as a commitment mechanism if we take a more kind of behavioral lens. And so ultimately, this trade-off between repayment flexibility, timing, and frequency really depends on borrower circumstances. And designing loan products that align with income cycles, liquidity needs, and borrower characteristics is critical. And striking this balance remains an open area of research with much to explore.
Another innovation, tying loans to buying specific assets, specific things. How successful has that been?
Asset-based microfinance has demonstrated significant potential as a way, as you said, to provide loans that are tied to particular investments.
Yeah.
You know, Simon mentioned lumpy investments. Often these financial products allow borrowers to acquire larger productive assets, such as transportation vehicles or water tanks that can be used to generate income for households, or even housing, which can improve living conditions. And so one key feature is that the asset itself often serves as collateral, which makes it viable for the lender to actually extend a larger loan, which is, moves us actually beyond microfinance. And so there's research in Kenya, which, for example, shows exciting possibilities of contractual innovations that I've mentioned. In particular, they look at the collateralization of the loan, and it was a water tank, and take up increased dramatically from 2% to 40% when the asset itself was allowed to be used as collateral rather than a conventional collateral. Also, asset-based financing specifically for women is also a very exciting area and can have transformational effects. So in the lit, we describe financing lumpy investments such as motorcycles in Brazil, which improved women's mobility and economic opportunities, and also their safety with a reduction in mortality rates from assaults. In other places, we've seen asset-based financing specifically women improve employment rates and earnings. Digital collateral, where when a borrower misses a payment, the possibility of temporarily locking an asset rather than physically repossessing it and selling it does expand the feasibility of these kinds of loans for microfinance institutions and financial institutions. And so it highlights how creative use of collateral can facilitate this kind of asset-based financing and make it more accessible and sustainable.
Perhaps inevitably, we have seen a commercialization of microfinance. And so we see banks, for example, offering microfinance. What benefits of microfinance for profit, I suppose I could call it, are there? What challenges are there with it?
So in my response to this, I'll briefly draw upon some insights from a special issue of the Oxford Review of Economic Policy on microfinance, which I highly recommend for further reading, as well as the Vox Dev Lit. So microfinance institutions operating on a for-profit model, it presents some opportunities and some challenges. In terms of benefits, there's a potential to expand outreach because it allows MFIs to scale beyond the constraints of donor budgets, potentially more underserved populations and operating more sustainably. And market can also foster innovation, such as digital payments and wallet money, which could reduce costs in the future. However, there are challenges. Sometimes people refer to this as mission drift. So the pursuit of profitability can lead to a focus on wealthier clients at the expense of the poorest borrowers and women and the hardest to reach clients. So NGOs do often serve poorer clients, and they tend to rely less actually on subsidies per borrower than commercial MFIs, which typically provide larger loans to better off borrowers. This emphasis on profitability can exclude sometimes the most vulnerable customers who can't afford the highest rates. Some have argued that subsidies remain crucial to ensuring inclusion, but it's an ongoing conversation. In terms of high interest rates, for-profit MFIs often do charge high interest rates, which can really discourage borrowing and limit some benefits for customers. Studies have shown that borrowers are quite sensitive to rates, and demand can reduce significantly when interest rates are high.
Microfinance seems to be one of these topics where every time we answer a question, it raises one or two more. There seems to be a lot we don't understand or we don't fully understand yet. What about future research? Where would that be most effective?
For us as researchers, it's not necessarily a bad thing if we have more questions to pursue. So I think future research on microfinance could focus on several promising areas, which we've already mentioned. Microfinance is highly diverse, and borrowers use credit for all sorts of different reasons, from business investment to what economists sometimes call consumption smoothing. And so a one-size-fits-all model doesn't effectively serve all borrowers. Further studies are and should test more tailored products. We've mentioned a little bit about larger loans for experienced entrepreneurs to encourage business growth, and also asset-based financing tied to specific productive assets. Second point I wanted to mention was digitization, which everybody is talking about. And so this revolution in digital financial services offers many opportunities to redesign financial products for the poor. We're exploring some work on performance contingent financing, where the repayments better track the borrower outcomes, which are more able to observe with digital data. I've already mentioned digital collateralization, so innovations for locks for assets temporarily can reduce default risks and reduce the reliance on traditional repossession methods used by banks, and improved targeting from more granular data, just very detailed data on potential borrowers, which can improve the credit allocation or can potentially reach people who were previously excluded, and also potentially improve the products that are offered to people. I mentioned things about seasonality and trying to understand when somebody has faced a liquidity shock. This very high frequency data can better help us to identify these things. And the final thing that I wanted to mention is measuring broader effects, how it affects local economies, labor markets, and competition beyond direct outcomes on borrowers. And so this is actually consistent with other literature, such as cash transfer literature, where they're very much thinking now about the impact of cash transfers on broader economies.
One thing I just want to add is related with his first point about heterogeneity effect. Although overall, there does not seem to be a transformative effect, but there can be some subgroups of boroughs who can benefit more from microfinance programs. So how to design effective like targeting programs to figure out who can be the beneficiaries could be important. So there are some reasons to work on this, including using community information or collect psychometrical data to do the prediction. I would want to see more research in this area to figure out what are the other cost-effective and easy-to-implement ways to do the targeting.
Now, one of my philosophies for research these days is to agree with Muhammad and Jing whenever possible. And I'm going to follow. Nothing to add. I agree with everything they've said.
Thank you very much, guys. I'd better let you go now, not least because Simon, who's joining us from his car today, has the school run to do.
Let me add, I'm not driving down an A road.
You are parked at the moment. Muhammad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Jing.
Thank you.
And finally, Simon.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
You can find the VoxDev Lit on microfinance at voxdev.org. This has been a VoxDev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe, you find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are also at voxdev.org. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us.